Meanwhile, in the JLI role-playing module from Mayfair Games entitled Come On Down, copyright 1990.
Welcome to episode 14 of DCRPG, the Hero Points Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Game Master Siskoid.
And I'm the irredeemable player, Shag. Now, in addition to this being an episode of Hero Points, this is also an episode of the Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast. Specifically, this is another of our Meanwhile episodes. And in these Meanwhile episodes, we break from the usual numbered issues to provide a chance to look at the JLI outside of the ongoing monthly series.
We are covering an adventure module for the DC Heroes RPG starring Justice League Europe. It's Come On Down. This is an adventure for use with the second edition DCH released in 1990. And Shag, this is one of four JLI-related products in Mayfair's DC Heroes line. It's the last, in fact, which is why we're doing this crossover episode.
Exactly right. The first one we did was the Justice League Sourcebook. And that one wasn't technically a crossover of our podcast. We just did that on Hero Points. But we covered that back in January 2017. You can still find that, again, on Hero Points, or it's part of the Let's Roll podcast feed, really. Then we covered the Justice League International module called Exposed, also on the Hero Points podcast, where we actually did a live role-playing session back in June 2020, which was an absolute blast. Again, you can find that on Hero Points or Let's Roll feed. Then last year, or actually, year and a half ago, we did the JLI module called When a Stranger Calls, where we covered that whole adventure. It was came out in the very early days of Justice League International. And again, that's on both Hero Points and the JLI podcast. And now this final JLI-themed role-playing module, all about Justice League Europe, which is kind of interesting that they got their own. You know, are they big enough to support that? Question we can answer later.
Right. I think it's almost more for variety, you know, not always give the same characters the modules. This show, I mean, the Hero Points itself is there to celebrate the different DC role-playing games, but especially the DC Heroes one from Mayfair. You're also listening to this on the Let's Roll feed because Hero Points is not dead. It just comes up once a year or so. but it is part of our role-playing coverage here at the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And our mission statement remains the same. This is for nostalgia's sake. It's not some technical, you know, dissection of the rules and the mathematics behind the rules. That's not what we do.
Well, if you look on table 16-7, it says here, if you roll a 32, that this happens.
Yes, we may get nerdy at times, but that is not our focus.
We're not going to get that nerdy.
No, this is for the lapsed gamer, the person who remembers DCH but hasn't played it in forever or thinks of playing it, because all these games can be found, you know, as PDFs somewhere, somehow. And there will be spoilers. This is still like a pretty old game, so there will be spoilers for players. If you're a game master, keep listening. If you're a player, think about what you're doing, and you may still decide to listen.
Be responsible. You know, I'm springing this on Siskoid right here and now. He doesn't even know I was thinking about this. But, you know, if we're hoping to keep the Hero Points podcast alive, and the JLI podcast does end, sadly, this August, you know, I'm going to be doing monthly coverage of the JSA, and there's a couple of JSA products we could be talking about someday on one of these Hero Points, now that we think about it.
There's one source book in particular, Shag, that we've been wanting to cover since forever.
Yeah.
And we've just been lazy about reading the book.
You know, really over.
It's long, it's big, it's rich, it's deep. But yeah, I'm totally on board to do that. And there may be some other products as well that fit the era, the golden age.
There's the West End Games JSA sourcebook too, which is excellent, by the way. Either way,
that's true.
This is all for another day. But that doesn't. I'm just thinking we could keep our once a year ish record alive if we want. Well, folks, since this is part of the JLI podcast, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of JLI podcast and Hero Points is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from that InStockTrades library. It's usually tied under discussion in some way, shape, or form. I don't know about you, Siskoid, but the first thing I did was I actually looked for role-playing books, and the Marvel role-playing game is out on InStock, but it's not terribly cheap, so I didn't pick that. Instead, I picked something more themed with Justice League Europe, specifically one of my favorite characters who didn't get enough time on the team, which is Animal Man, or as he might be called, Animal Man.
Man.
So this is Animal Man by Grant Morrison, hardcover, book one, 30th anniversary deluxe edition, because they couldn't make that title long enough. What this does is it collects Animal Man 1 through 10 and Secret Origins number 39, which is really the first run by Grant Morrison and Chas Truog, you know, with all the great covers by Brian Bolland. It goes into just, it starts off as a sort of four-issue miniseries that is so interesting. They expand it. Then you get to issue 5 and it blows everyone's mind. It's just like, wow, you can do this in a comic. And it just goes from there. And the story includes the issue where he joins the Justice League Europe, or at least the Justice League Europe comes to his house to retrofit everything with transporters. Everything. It's super fun. So this is a hardcover. You can normally get it for $34.99, but in stock trades, you can get it for 42% off. So it's only $20.29. And if you've never read these Animal Man comics, I cannot recommend them highly enough. They're really exceptional. Now, did you happen to bring anything, buddy?
I did. So I was looking at the characters that are in here, and like you, you use Animal Man. I looked and I looked and I looked. A lot of these characters, their projects were not, I don't know, they weren't put into trades.
They're not currently in print. Let's put
currently in print, exactly. So I went with the Challengers of the Unknown Archives Volume 1 hardcover because Ultivac.
Ultivac
is one of the villains in here, and Ultivac was one of the Challengers of the Unknown's first villains. And so because he appears in Challengers number 7, or really, you know, in Showcase number 7, starring the Challengers is what I should say, he's in part of this collection. So it's 4 years before Jack Kirby and Stan Lee created Marvel's Fantastic Four. There was another adventurous foursome co-created by Kirby that set forth to challenge the unknown. Now witness those early adventures again in a specially priced hardcover volume that collects Showcase 6, 7, Ultivac, 11, and 12, and Challengers of the Unknown 1 and 2, originally published 1957 to 1958. For more information, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I'm just reading from the blurb here. Of course, you can normally get it for $39.99. The in-stock trades price is $23.19. You save 42% here as well. And I mean, these books, this isn't as thick as some of the other archive books. So it was a little bit cheaper, but those books were always like the most expensive in the comic book store back in the day.
Yes.
You know, today, omnibus editions, like these little giant bricks, you know, are like the top items. But back in the day, it's like, oh, man, I really want some of these. But they're out of my price range. No more, friends.
Well, and they produce them on such incredibly high quality paper. I mean, when they call it Archive Edition, it really was always intended to be a really quality product that would last for years and years. You know, I mean, my JLI, I bought the first, I don't know, it's like 7 volumes of the archives. Mm-hmm. And they look, I mean, that was, good Lord, what, 30 years ago? I don't know, 20 years ago? Whenever those things started. Anyway, they look brand new still today. I mean, that's how great the paper is and the coloring and everything. So they're fantastic. And Challenge of the Unknown, that's super fun. So great pick. So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. We also will be thanking our Patreon sponsors at the end of the program. But for right now, let's get doing this, man. Let's talk about Come On Down.
Yeah, let's look at this thing. So the cover art by Paris Cullins, Romeo Tangal, and Bob LaRose doing colors. It's a giant manga con in the background making victory signs, if you look closely.
Yep.
What is he doing? As the JLE and the Forgotten Villains, there's your Ultivac, fight in front of a live studio audience. So let's talk a little bit about this one. For me, this is my one note about the cover art. Mm-hmm. It looks sketchy for this art team. So I'm wondering if it was drawn smaller, because look at the lines. I mean, it looks like they've been blown up.
Something isn't right here. And this is a reoccurring thing, because you're right. Paris Cullins and Romeo Tangal are very polished artists, right? Especially around 1990. I mean, their stuff looks slick. So there's no reason it should look this rough. Almost like a sketch or maybe blown up, whatever it is. And the strange thing is there's the same sort of sketchiness on Kevin Maguire's JLI source book as well. Mm. The same sort of sketchiness. So I don't know. I mean, I can speculate a million things. I don't know if it has something to do with the way they commissioned it or the way that the amount of time they were asked to spend on it. I don't know. But it you're right. It's a little lacking. I mean, the composition's fine, but yeah, the line work itself is a little off. I do like Animal Man leaping. I love to see him using his powers anytime, and you know, you get what you want. You get Captain Atom with his eyes glowing. You get Power Girl, you know, being Power Girl's cleavage. You got the villains in the background. So it's a fun shot. The studio audience is probably the most confusing part until you read the module. Because it looks like, I don't know, towns villagers, you know, massing on them or something, unless you know what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's a little weird. And so they're so dark, you don't even notice them in the first place. But it's one of these covers where they match the heroes to the villains. They're facing each other. There have been many classic covers like this.
Mm-hmm.
So Captain Atom versus Dr. Spectro, which makes sense. And
mm-hmm.
and they do have Power Girl versus Enchantress, who is a member of the Forgotten Villains normally, but is not in this book.
Right. And that would be the blonde Enchantress, not the dark-haired Enchantress from Suicide Squad, which is who they drew on the cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same person.
True.
Yeah. But I know. Yeah. So it's June Moon shouldn't be in here whatsoever. I do think it's interesting that they went and got Paris Cullins for this because he did draw the Forgotten Heroes and Forgotten Villains for Who's Who.
Oh, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Okay.
So I don't know if that's how they got to it. The title itself, Come On Down, is in a weird font and a weird color. It sort of almost also disappears in the image, I think. So it's not the best cover I've ever seen, but I mean, the superhero action does draw the eye, I suppose. Oh, there is a word bubble.
Yeah.
So Elongated Man says, we've got to stop meeting like this, as if they ever met.
I do. I'm a sucker for a word balloon on a cover.
Yeah.
I really am. And I love it when, you know, Ralph's cracking some kind of joke or something here. But that one, you're right, doesn't make any sense. About the logo real quick. I don't know if you remember. This is 1990, so we're talking back then. I don't know if you remember a program called Print Shop, which
sure.
we all used to use to make banners, and you could do logos and fonts and like – the logo looks not hand-drawn to me. The logo looks like computer-generated and certainly computer-generated coloring, which I know someone was trying to do something cool with it, but the gradients just don't work because you're right. They just it disappears into the background.
There was those options. You know, you took your text and you made it, you know, they're just like these different templates. Yep. And this was probably one of the templates.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. You do the wave and you do the color. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
it's wavy and shiny and doubled. Yeah. No. Quickly, the back cover.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing here is, you know, obviously you get your blurb about what the adventure is about and what you get when you buy this product. And there's a little picture of Metamorpho there that's taken from the second edition box set cards.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we'll see some of that art inside as well when they show the heroes. And then there's like these newspaper articles, which are referred to in the module itself, but they are written in French because it's a Parisian newspaper,
mm-hmm.
The Daily Planet Paris, I guess. And I will confirm, although this is not normal for this kind of product, but I will confirm that all of these articles are legit French.
They're not
badly written. They're written by a French person, as far
That's
as I can tell.
Crazy. I just assume, like, you know when you see fake, like, print, mm-hmm. and it's, like, usually in Latin, and it's that, like, repeated Latin stuff, and you're like, okay, that's just filler space or whatever? I just assumed it was some kind of filler space.
No.
This is legit. Is it anything to do with the adventure? Or is
it is. You know, in the adventure, at some point, they find these articles, and somebody translates them for them.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Catherine Colbert will translate them. This is exactly the translations.
That's
and it's
crazy.
It's even in a journalistic speak. Like, I was very impressed. Like, for me, as a French Game Master player, this is what I would have photocopied. This is what I would have given my players.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, directly.
Wow. They should have hired whoever did that for Alpha Flight.
Exactly. And I mean, in comics, usually, whenever there's French, it's terrible.
Yeah.
The grammar's all wrong. But in this case, no. Well done. Well done, Mayfair. But maybe they were getting their games translated for France. I don't know about any French editions, but it's possible. And then just use that service. I don't know. But I'm very happy with it. As far as the interior art, it's art from the comics, except for those second edition cards, which were original to the game. I didn't actually play where is this from? I recognize some.
Well, some of it, like the Booster Gold picture is, I'm pretty sure, from an early issue, but it was definitely also used in the last module we covered as well. So
it's not an early issue because look at the haircut.
Oh, okay.
So this was like a cover for, I think it's on a cover or something like in the later issues.
Okay.
But regardless, yeah, I mean, there's some JLI art. There's Dr. Spectro is from Pat Broderick, so that's from Captain Atom.
I like how you get the JLA satellite to represent the Mega Con spaceship.
Exactly, like whatever the space station.
Yeah. So the maps are original, but yeah, I think all the character artwork is repurposed. Yeah, probably true.
Yeah. So that's our outside. Let's get inside.
All right, so the inside cover is a tool you can use called the Wheel of Jeopardy, which we can talk about later, but this is the pocket guide that you could use. You could photocopy that for your players. But then on the credits page, you get 1990. This is a release there. And it does point this out. Actually, it says it on the back, if I remember right. But this is the very first full-length module for your use for second edition DC Heroes. So second edition had just come out, and I guess this was the first module they released, which is kind of exciting, I guess. And it was written by Ray Wininger, who did a lot of Mayfair game stuff, and Jack Barker, who I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, and it is a sequel to Exposed, which was the adventure, the sample adventure in the box set.
Mm-hmm.
The first two adventures are linked, in other words. But because there is a time difference, you know, I feel like Exposed is about the Manhunter tapes.
Yeah.
That have all the secrets of your heroes on it. So in my games, I played it after Millennium sometime. And then this adventure seems to take place after Invasion, because Earth has been recognized by other races as like a place.
Well, Invasion is what launched Justice League Europe. So it would have to take place after Invasion.
Yes, exactly. So in other words, it has to take place a little further on. And I'll share this with you now, but we'll talk about this later. I never did get to run it.
Okay.
I don't know. It's like, well, I want to put some adventures in between. I did play Exposed for the players. You know, group dissolve,
sure,
whatever.
Right.
And then we never got to play it. I'm not sure that's a bad thing after reading it today, because there are a lot of problems with it, but I also know how to fix it. So we get to talk about all of this.
Well, so that's one of the things from the Game Master's introduction, which is the next section, is that I did feel like when I was reading, at least the Game Master's description, and it kind of proved out as I went through the module, it does feel a bit on rails, meaning that the players have to do action one to get to action two to get to action three. And whether they want to or not, that's the direction they're going to go. There's not a lot of room for them to randomly wander off and go do something else. And that's, I mean, that's the style of modules at the time, but they have to follow very specific clues. And it even encourages the GM to be punitive with rewards if the players miss clues. You know, I would prefer you rather encourage the GM to coach the players towards solutions, but that's the way it's written here. And for me, like when I run a game, and I ran a game just the other day for my friends, like I can't have a format this structure, which is like you go into room A and this has to happen to room A. And if it doesn't happen, then you've missed out a whole plot point. For me, I like, you know, my characters went into a building that was on fire and I just wrote down like stairwells collapsing, ceiling tiles falling, holes in the floor, fires. And I didn't plan out where any of that was going to happen. It just whatever room they went to, that's where that crap was going to happen. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You let the players craft the story and you write it around them is more my philosophy.
I think you're absolutely correct with that. I mean, it does seem to encourage you to coach the players towards solutions, but it's very blatant about it. So I don't mind it if, you lose XP at the end. You know, it's like if I gave you the answer, then you can't get XP for finding the answer. Mm-hmm. Fine. But I agree with you that I think the whole tone of it, very often the writers will go back to the idea of, well, this is impossible. Like, yeah. If the players try to do this, it's just not possible. If the players try to do this, get them back on track and get it back to this. And sometimes I feel it's not necessary. You know, it's like, this cannot happen. Why not? Why can't it happen? Like, we're going to get into the plot of it later, but there is a point where, you know, you should be using the transporters from this place to get to a space station because the JLI transporters can't get you there. Well, why not? Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you get there. So I feel like it's very strict with the game master and with the players. It's like almost aggressively so. So I agree with you.
It's either padding to try to pad it out to full length, or they're trying to, and we'll get into this in a bit, take advantage of the European setting. Because like, okay, you have to go to, Paris, then you have to go to, I think it's Italy, and then you mm-hmm. have to go to Switzerland. And it could be, though, that they're just trying to play out the way a Justice League comic works. And, you know, you've got to do your investigation first rather than just jump right to the big moment. And you have to, if you're Justice League Europe, especially in those early issues, you got to take advantage of the setting. And that may be just what they're trying to do.
It's possible. And it's also if it's the first adventure of this particular edition, it may be the first adventure anyone gets.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're maybe trying to steer the thing to show how the game works.
Hmm.
But it's kind of teaching the wrong things.
we've hopefully all evolved as game masters. So,
right. I mean, I understand that like an adventure like this, which is about getting like the Manhunter tapes have been copied and okay, we need to get the Manhunter tapes again. And you can't possibly steal the tape because that just like erases the whole adventure. There's no point to the adventure. And all the fun stuff is not stealing the tape. It's everything else you have to do to get the tape. And this was also a concern in Exposed. And you guys, when you played it, because that was our live game, you did go to the tape room. I think Firestorm tried to Firestorm all the tapes away or something, right?
Well, that's what I would do. Yeah.
Yes.
I tried to erase them with a magnet or something like that. Yeah.
Right. And I, of course, and you, I mean, you've got the matter transformation powers. You can just like turn them all into, I don't know, you know, whatever, cotton candy. So my ploy, I don't remember what I did. I didn't re-listen to the episode, you know, recently. But what my job is well, the tape wasn't in that room, or the, you know, the tape was somehow otherwise protected.
Exactly.
You know, otherwise it's, there's a lot of this that is follow the clues, which is normal. And you're even allowed to jump to conclusions. I think you can skip the French Connection, for example. So it's not that railroady, but the tone of it, the writing of it seems to say, do railroad your players into this.
Yeah.
And I always felt like, no, I think we can have more flexibility and it'll still work.
Yeah, definitely.
In any case. So, okay, well, after the introduction, we get to all those character stats that we love to talk about.
Woohoo! Yeah, you know I'm going to get a little nerdy here, folks, because this is what we're here for, right? We're here to talk about Justice League Europe. So, real quickly, included are Captain Atom, Animal Man, Elongated Man, The Flash, Metamorpho, Power Girl, and Rocket Red. So you've got the group there, which is wonderful. And reading through this, I mean, I went through this stuff with a fine-tooth comb here. And to me, it is clearly written in the very early days of Justice League Europe. So this is copyrighted 1990. The problem is we don't know what month it was released. So I can't tell you exactly when, but I can tell you that on the shelves in January 1990 was issue number 11 of Justice League Europe. And reading this, it seems to me that they had a clue what was going to happen through issue 9. To be specific about that is they talk about how Power Girl got injured and she had surgery and she was depowered after a result of the surgery, which was issue 9. Also, Rex had met Sapphire, his wife, and got his memory back. That was issue, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 5 or somewhere in there. But there's no mention of like Crimson Fox, who first appeared and joined the team in issue 10. So it's quite possible that this was either written as issue 9 was published, or they were working from Giffen's notes, which could be quite, or the editor's notes or something like that. Because I believe when we did Stranger Calls, that was clearly, a lot of that was built from Giffen's notes, because there was stuff in there that never came to be. There were some plots that they never even did.
Oh, yeah.
I do think it's adorable that in the JLE, they give everyone stats, but they do talk about Wonder Woman, how she's a member of the JLE, and they're encouraging you not to play her. But I just think it's adorable that at this time, they actually thought Wonder Woman was a member of the JLE. That's so cute.
Yeah, but there's always this one player, right? You're going to try to push it.
Right, or the player who doesn't show up for the session.
Yeah.
That would be,
and they don't
too.
Want you to play Wonder Woman, they say, but at the same time, as we're going to see, Wonder Woman's power levels aren't that high compared to like Captain Atom. Or...
Which is weird, but I guess this is, I mean, we're only a little while after Legends, so I guess maybe she hadn't gelled as a character yet to be the power level she eventually becomes. But
I think she's too dignified to be in this adventure.
That's, well, she was too dignified to be in Justice League Europe. So
apparently.
So let's look at Captain Atom real quick. He's the first character here. I love that he's missing the advantage of leadership, and they specifically say that. And well, you say what you're going to say, because I know where you're going, and I'm going to argue with you, because I like doing that.
I still think it's absurd, even in the comic, for a military officer not to have that skill, and especially after Invasion, where he's leading the entire, like, he's been chosen to lead all the superheroes, and you don't even have Superman or Batman saying, nah, you know, he is the leader of the human, you know, forces. But I'll accept it because he was just outed as a spy. They don't entirely trust him, so it's not that he doesn't have leadership, it's that, you know, the others won't be led. So I think he's got leadership, but not, you know, limitation, not the JLE.
Well, that certainly plays out in the comics. Like, he had no control over that team for a long time, and nobody listened to him. So the fact that he doesn't have it and they call out here fits very well with the tone of the comic. And I would argue, you know, keep in mind, Captain Atom, I don't even know. I assume he actually was a captain in the military. I don't actually know, because a lot of his origin was false. Remember? Like, he was in trouble with our Air Force when they had to do this experiment in the 60s. So there may be a chance where he never really commanded very many people. And so he may not have had a chance for those skills. And in Invasion, did he really lead them, or did he just show. I don't remember the details enough of Invasion. I knew a guy who did a podcast about it, but he's a bit of a flake.
No. I remember quite well, like, the first Captain Atom issues and how the fake story was crafted. But there was in the real story, he really is an Air Force captain.
Okay. All right.
You know, he was. They just don't want to reveal that, you know, that he participated in the secret project and that he's from another time and so on. And then they wanted to do a Charlton bit with it, right? Like, the fake history is the Charlton history.
Yeah, right.
Nevertheless, he's an Air Force captain, not only in the past, but in the present. He's still an Air Force captain.
Well, in this case, the fault does not lie with the module. The fault lies with Giffen DeMatteis' stories, then, if you want to say that. Although, I would say there's no fault there, because they're perfect. But
like I said, I've no prized it.
So, in here, they give Captain Atom strength of 22. Which to me seems really high. You know, Superman's a 25. Now, I do realize it's an exponential system, so that means, you know, Superman's infinitely stronger than him, whatever. But it puts him higher than Captain Marvel, higher than Wonder Woman, and higher than Martian Manhunter. And that just, I don't know. I have a hard time with that. Like, Captain Atom didn't, I think he got stronger as he went along in Justice League Europe, but I don't feel like he should have been a 22 out of the gate.
It wasn't his main power.
Right.
So it just feels like, really? Okay. Yeah. But like I said, if you can have him at strength 22, you can have Wonder Woman in this.
Yeah. I mean, goodness gracious. Then we got to go to one of my favorites, Animal Man. So here, he has a special limitation. I don't need to go into the details of it, but it has to do with his animal power. But it's interesting that the second edition book was just published, you know, a few months before this, and they are already making adjustments. They're already making special notes here that say, like, you know, they're adjusting his powers to accommodate the hero. It could be, too, that maybe since then the comic book, Grant Morrison had redone his origin. I think he did. And so maybe they're saying, oh, well, this, you know, this limitation's gone now. So they're having to update that kind of thing.
It's possible. Yeah. And there's a, you know, a new sub-rule to allow proportional abilities of insects, because Grant Morrison definitely let him do that, like the reflexes of a fly and that sort of thing. And that actually came really useful in my campaign, because we had a character who had animal mimicry, but it was insects only. Like, he started, Swarm was the name of the character. And he originally, he was a sort of Egyptian guy with, you know, like a staff that controlled insects. But then through a subplot, his powers changed because he's kind of unhappy with them, I think. And then so he became more of a bug person with animal mimicry. It's either that or the opposite. But I did use this. The sub-rule about proportional strength of spiders, you know, that kind of thing.
Smart way to go. I mean, it makes sense. And seven seems like a reasonable number for that, too. By the way, if you're a player, dude, if you haven't played an animal mimicry character, highly recommend it. Ton of fun. So much variety of powers you get to play with. Really a great power set to have. Sometimes could break the game. I used to do that to my GM a little too much. It was very clever enough to go, well, I'll try this and this. He's like, okay. And you find a way to work around it, of course. But, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, break out the safari cards.
Then we move on to Elongated Man. And I just got to say something here. This is not the fault of the book. But the book talks about how he's got this weakness. And it's a drawback here where he has to drink gin gold extract to maintain his powers. And I know that's his weakness because I read it in a role-playing book. In 40-something years of reading comics, I don't think I have ever seen that once in a comic book.
Who says regularly? He has to drink it regularly. Okay. So even who says it? Neither have I. I think maybe this was maybe a plot point in the Silver Age.
Sure.
Here and there. But not in his modern appearances, nah.
Right, exactly. So
it felt like he always had. He always had enough gin gold.
And then he's got his danger sense, which is great, but they don't mention his nose twitching. That just that makes me sad, because that's like his shtick. You know, that's the thing that people love, especially in the early JLE issues. They were always making fun of him for that. Now, all right, we get from him to have the Flash in here, which is great. It's early days of Wally. Then we get into Metamorpho. Now, I got to ask you, as a GM, like, Metamorpho scares me. When I look at his power set, you know, Molecular Chameleon, Self-Manipulation, Omni-Arm, the dude can literally turn himself into anything. You know, as long as the chemical compound exists in the human body, at least that's what he's supposed to be able to turn into. Although they don't even...
They
don't even say that here. Either way, it seems to me like that's a game-breaking power. Like, I would have a hard time as a GM. I don't know. I'd be afraid as a GM, like, my player would think of everything to get around everything.
Well, he'd be Metamorpho. You know, just like I wasn't scared of having you play Firestorm
Yeah.
In that early adventure, it doesn't really matter. You know, it's a power. And yeah. it's a more interesting power than just like throwing blasts or being strong. I would say that in this module, the real game breaker, the dangerous character, is not Metamorpho, is not Animal Man. They're mm-hmm. just very, they have a lot of variety.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're fun. I think Flash.
Oh, yeah. Super Speed's always a pain in the butt.
Super Speed. Super Speed 10. So you can, like, do 10 actions per turn. Mm-hmm. That is the game breaker. That is the one you got to watch out for. That's why a lot of this stuff where they say, no matter what, the heroes can't do this. No matter what, they can't find such a person in the crowd. No matter what, they can't search this thing. Wait a minute. The Flash may be in there. And the Flash can do 10 actions per second, you know, basically. So, no, I don't believe you when you say it is absolutely impossible to find Manga Khan in the crowd. You've got the Flash. There's no way this can't be done. You know,
that was always one of the flaws of the TV show too, was like, you know, Flash should have been able to take care of almost any situation. And I had a role-playing game where I had a player who played a speedster, and we kind of had an unwritten rule, which was like, look, don't be a dick. That's kind of what it was. It's like, use your power, absolutely, but don't ruin the game for everybody, because, you know, they don't even need to be here, honestly, with that power set.
Leave some for the others.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So then we get into what I find the most fascinating set of statistics in here is Power Girl. Because this is Power Girl post-surgery. She's been depowered at this point. And the real reason behind the scenes was they didn't want two Kryptonians running around. Because it's post-crisis, right?
Right.
So they lower her stats, and they removed... And in fact, she was just published in second edition with the original power set, and now she's being published here, you know, just a few months later, with the lower stats. But to me, they still don't look right. And maybe I'm just being too big of a nerdy critical, and also... keeping in mind when this was published, they may not even really know what her powers were going to be like. You know, they may have just been throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. They may not have had a clue. Because, like, here it lists that she has flight still. Well, she doesn't. After the surgery, she's pretty much supposed to be the Golden Age Superman. That's supposed to be the power level she's at, is pretty much Golden Age Superman. And so at that point, she has leaping. She can't fly anymore, so she shouldn't have flight. That's an example. So what I did was I pulled up the Golden Age Superman stats, which appear in the World at War sourcebook that you and I were talking about, or hinting around at earlier, which is an amazing JSA sourcebook, guys. Anyway, so comparing Golden Age Superman to Power Girl here, like, I think her strength is way too high. They list her at a 20, which is just below Captain Atom, whereas, like, the Golden Age Superman is only an 11. So, I mean, that's half of that, but, you know, since it's an exponential system, it's much less than that. Her body is probably about a third too high. She's a 15, probably should be a mark of 10. Again, she should have jumping, not flight. Super speed. So she has a super speed at 11, which puts her faster than Flash, faster than Wally West. No way. There's no way that's happening. So she should, and the Golden Age Superman only had a super speed of 2, which actually makes more sense for her to me. Now, that's the Golden Age Superman as of Superman number 1, so an argument could be made that his stats went up over time. But either way, I do think that her power levels are way too high. What do you think?
No, I agree, especially if you're going to have her in this, you know, I was just talking about Flash having super speed 10, which was almost a game breaker. She's got super speed 11, so you got two super speedsters in the team. So just on that level, it's problematic,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you would have, like, basically a character here that outclasses several other characters. Like, I do everything you do, but better.
right.
Is kind of annoying for the player who plays the Flash,
mm-hmm.
essentially. I would agree with you that this is too early for them to know how downgraded she's been.
Yeah.
In terms of powers. And then they just went with the Kryptonian suite of powers. They just removed, like, the senses.
Well, they basically removed the laser eyes powers, too. And stuff
right.
Like
yeah.
That
all
too.
The eye powers, the ear mm-hmm. powers, that's gone. But they kept a lot of, you know, like, you know, it's got recall. That's like a super memory. That's we've never seen her use this, you know.
True.
I don't know. So it's too close to what Superman has, even though it's much lower than what Superman has. They didn't go far down enough.
Yeah. And like we said, it may have just been they didn't know where they were going to land. Because, I mean,
Probably didn't.
It took a while for them to really even roll her out into the comics after the surgery. So, I mean, they stated what her powers were during the surgery, but then afterwards, it took a while till she was really back in there.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole thing in here about her background, which I found hilarious, because they really go into details on her Atlantean heritage and all that, and there's actually more about her Atlantean heritage in this little blurb than there was in the entire Justice League Europe series under Giffen and DeMatteis. And then there's a bit here that says she's heading up the war against the Lords of Chaos in her free time, and I'm like, what the hell is that? Is that from the miniseries or something?
It was in the miniseries. Paul Kupperberg wrote that miniseries where she's fighting the Weaver, who was an Atlantean god / Lord of Chaos. Guy in a bare chest who appeared in a Who's Who update. And that continued in the last few issues of Paul Kupperberg's Doom Patrol as well. So, yeah, that was like a Kupperberg storyline that was going on regardless of her appearances in JLE.
So I since I've never read that miniseries, I didn't have a clue. All right.
Yeah.
And then the last character is Rocket Red number 13.
I don't know why they keep calling him number 13 at this point. He doesn't have the Soviet suit. He's no longer numbered. I think he's just Rocket Red.
That's a good point. Now, you know, one thing the book doesn't address, because it's the players, you know, that make these decisions at this point. But one of the things I love about Justice League Europe is almost everyone, with the exception of Captain Atom, goes by their secret identity. So, like, he's not Rocket Red. He's Dimitri. Wally is Wally. Rex is Rex. I mean, they literally all call each other by their real names. Captain Atom's the only exception because I guess he distinct, like, they didn't know he was Nathaniel, really, until I think right before the end.
I think a distance.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to be the leader. And also all the government stuff, the weird government stuff.
Yeah, it was nice to go through all this.
Which one would you have played in this?
Oh, jeez.
Let's say we're going to play. We got somebody, David Gallagher's running this. We get to play one of these six.
The one I would enjoy the most would be Animal Man.
Yeah, I think so too. Same. We'd have to fight for it.
Well, realistically, though, I would probably end up playing Power Girl because I don't know what it is. I always gravitate towards the bruisers. I gravitate towards the tanks who can punch people in games. I don't know why. It's my comfort spot. I like to have a reason to punch first and ask questions later in a game, which pisses off most GMs, but that's just the way I play.
Then I can do Animal Man, but if I didn't have access to Animal Man, I think maybe Elongated Man would be a fun...
Oh, sure.
You know, just fun role-playing.
Yep.
And be the detective, which is actually useful in this.
Metamorpho would be fun just to try and create puzzles for myself of, like, what all I could do.
Yeah, yeah. I think those two, Animal Man and Metamorpho, are the ones, like, for the player who likes to think outside the box and do some research before the game and, you know, come in with some stock ideas or tactics.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think... I agree with you. Like Power Girl or Rocket Red, or like they're pretty simple to play. They fight. They're good at fighting. You know, if you don't want to learn all these extra rules and have these fights with the GM, that's the character for you.
Well, and Rocket Red's the heart of the team, truthfully. So if you're going to play him, you've got to be the personality that makes everyone feel better too. And I don't know if I have that in me.
Same.
All right, then we get into the non-player characters, and there's a big missing one here in the NPCs. Do you know the big giant missing hole in the couple of pages here?
Who's missing for you?
No, who's missing? You tell me. I'm asking you.
You mean there's someone in the adventure who is not covered, It's someone is not even in the adventure?
There's someone who's not even in the adventure, but this is Justice League Europe, so who should be a non-player character?
Who?
Sue Dibney.
You're right.
If they've got Catherine Colbert, they should have Sue Dibney. And it's heartbreaking to me that Sue's not in here. Anyway.
She has no role. Yeah. No, yeah. You're right.
Now, first NPC is Manga Khan. And I love here that, first of all, keep in mind, he's in the NPC section, not the bad guy section. They even tell you this. I love in the background. Manga Khan is not the villain of this module. Honest. It goes on and on about it. I just love the way it's written. It's so much fun. It's very tongue-in-cheek. And Manga Khan is in here, and he's got a shouting power of 10, which is great. I love shouting. Help me out here. There's a shouting power of 10. Is it actually in the game yet?
It was because the Justice League Swords book was already out, I think. Because it's in there. Because they mention it.
You're right.
I think that this is one of the weird things here is they say, the shouting power, go look at the Justice League source book. We don't have room for it here. Well, you did just like shrink some of the artwork or something. There's no reason where they couldn't be. It wasn't like a long power.
Actually, I don't think the Justice League Sourcebook had been published yet.
Oh my God, how are you going to use this then?
Because Crimson Fox is in the Justice League Sourcebook. So crazy
yeah,
sauce.
Okay, I'm not crazy. Yeah, I love shouting as well. I mean, it means that while the villain is monologuing, you can't do anything. Basically, right. It's like a social attack that prevents you from doing anything except listening to the monologue.
And it's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you JLI fans of the comic, and you're just listening to this episode of Humor, Cisco and I, thank you, you'll appreciate under the MangaCon's drawbacks, these abilities, which tie right back to the comic. He has a serious irrational attraction to talking out loud to himself. And he has catastrophic irrational attraction to profit. And then he has unluck because, I mean, come on. The guy's very unlucky. So that works really well for the comic.
And there's a number of little inside jokes in here that we'll highlight.
Of MangaCon or of the...
Oh, no,
of,
I mean, okay. generally.
Because I'm moving on to Catherine Colbert, because it's Catherine Colbert, generally.
Yeah.
So Catherine Colbert is in here, which is wonderful. I do have a question from... This is where I get nerdy and get out my slide roll, right? So Elrond is also in here. Hooray! This is before Elrond became a member of the team, keep in mind. This is when he's working for MangaCon, which is great. So Elrond's in here. Catherine Colbert's in here. They both have the same rank in this skill called Charisma, which I have a very hard time swallowing. That Catherine Colbert, let me say that again, Catherine Colbert has the same charisma as Elrond? That is horribly wrong.
Well, don't forget, charisma is the general convincing skill. It includes interrogation, persuasion, intimidation. Uh-huh. None of which fit Elrond.
Exactly. I was going to say, I mean, Elrond's cute and he's funny. I mean, that's where his charisma comes from. But, Catherine Colbert tells you what to do. First of all, she's the smartest person on the team. Second of all, she's stunning. And she does have the attractive advantage, so that helps.
Which gives her the bonus. You know, like, yeah, she's going to have a bonus with persuading males or people who are attracted to women. And that, so she'll always have the advantage in terms of persuasion. But yeah, I'm not sure that... I think Elrond needs this. It's a professional charisma skill.
Okay.
It's to deal with MangaCon.
Okay.
He needs that level of charisma to convince the boss that, you know, no, you're not doing that. Because he does have a certain control over MangaCon in a way.
Yeah, he does. He guides him, certainly.
I mean, it's sort of his version of leadership.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I can't really, you know, justify it.
I do think Catherine, a couple things. One, I think her mental abilities could be higher, like her intelligence and maybe willpower and maybe influence, things like that. Because, I mean, she's really painted as super intelligent. They say, like, she's a fashion template and all over Europe, and people watch her for what's going on in the world and they follow her example. So I think she could have that. But then also, I think this would be a good opportunity to introduce the double attractive advantage, because she's that smoking hot. So.
And I was talking about, like, those little inside jokes. If you look at the Elrond's motivation here, it's do what MangaCon says, which is not one of the classic, it's not one of the official motivations. And there are a couple of characters like that that have, like, this silly motivation.
Right.
Colbert, there's a reference to Captain Adam's ego that always needs reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, okay, at this point, I was going to leave the poor guy alone. I felt like this was a takedown of Captain Adam. Like, we already know that nobody listens to him and he doesn't have leadership, and let's talk about this some more, that he doesn't have leadership, and here he doesn't have confidence, and okay. You know, like, that. This makes me not want to play Captain Adam in this adventure.
Well, it's right out of the first 10, 12 issues of the comic, though. I mean, that is exactly what was going on, was she had to keep him on track, and she had to feed his ego, and there was sexual tension between them. I mean, all of it was there, laid out in the comic. So they're just showing you what's in the comic.
Mm-hmm. And plus, you get Juan Donovan, who returns from Exposed,
mm-hmm.
And a mob enforcer called Pierre Lefebvre.
Okay. And there's a gap where Sue Dibney should be. So anyway.
But there's no gap. I mean, there's no room.
Didn't need that picture of Elrond. Anyway, so, I mean, I love Elrond, don't get me wrong, but it's Sue Dibney, damn it. Anyway, so then we get into the section on the forgotten villains, which are the bad guys of this thing. But I love this whole section explaining to you about the forgotten villains in the real world. It tells you, you can read about them in DC Comics Presents 77 to 78. And it talks about how that was the last pre-crisis adventure, so that adventure never happened. So it even goes on here, it says, so it's pretty likely the forgotten villains also existed one form or another. You can make up your own mind what their continuity was before this adventure and use them from now on as you see fit. Which is like, wow, I love that they just completely turn the continuity over to the reader, because they know it's, you know, post-crisis craziness.
Also that these guys aren't very likely to reappear.
I guess that's true. Maybe Dr. Spectro, but the rest of them weren't.
Many of them have, actually.
Well, I just meant that no one was chomping at the bit for them.
No, definitely not.
So in here, as you're reading about this, they talk about the villains. They just simply hijack an intergalactic cable truck and take it, you know, a space truck to another galaxy, you know, as you do, which I just love the commonality of that. It's like, oh, yeah, they just steal a truck, a spaceship, and go to another galaxy. Like,
they also mentioned that Dr. Spectro basically use who's who to find the team. It's a certain who's who, but it's still, he used who's who.
Oh, that's funny.
To find information on these guys and specifically recruited them?
Yeah.
Dude, you know, set your sights higher. But not that they're not powerful. They're just like forgotten villains, right? Because many of them are actually powerful.
In full disclosure, and I'm sure I'm going to piss off some Bronze Age fans at this moment, I reread those DC Comics Presents issues with the Forgotten Heroes and the Forgotten Villains. Holy crap, those are some bad comics. I mean, it was painful for me to get through those comic books. I'm sorry if you love those. I love DC Comics Presents in general, but those particular issues were painful to read. So, yeah, I had, even after reading that, because I wanted to get a better idea who the villains were as I was going through this, and like, wow. Just, yeah, they could be forgotten for a reason. So,
yeah, I haven't read those DC Comics Presents issues, but I have read the original appearances of each of these villains.
I imagine that's more compelling than what the DC Comics Presents probably was.
I mean, it's interesting. You get a Sea Devil's villain. You get a Challenger's villain. The Faceless Hunter from Saturn is basically like in a monster comic. There's no known heroes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In that story or anything. It's just like some sort of strange tale, strange adventure type. It's in Strange Adventures. Although here they say it's in Mystery in Space, number 97.
Uh-huh.
Not the case. It's Strange Adventures, number 124.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, there's a number of misattributions here, like Ultivax first appearance. Showcase Comics, number one. First of all, there's no such thing as Showcase Comics.
Okay.
It's just Showcase.
Yeah,
and number two, it was Showcase number seven, which was the Challengers of the Unknown second ever appearance, which is the one that's in the collection that I shilled for at the top, right? So the other error, the big error, Cracklow is here called Krakow.
Oh.
Which is the capital.
Wrong.
Well, it's the capital of Poland. the country from which the villain comes from, you know, he comes from Poland. He's not called Krakow. He's called Cracklow.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's a mistake that they carry on throughout. You know, there's no,
Now you're making me sad here, because like one of the things I was really impressed with was within each character, they tell you the character's first appearance, which I thought was like really cool. I'm like, wow, okay. You know, Faceless Hunter first appeared in Mystery in Space 97. That's neat to know that. And then I'm finding out all this stuff was wrong. So that's a little disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, those are the mistakes. I think the other weird thing in the module throws up its hands in surrender, saying that the GM will have to improvise the fact that can only turn matter he touches. I mean, I'm talking about the Faceless Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he when he touches things, they turn into weapons and only weapons. But there's no game mechanic for this, so you're going to have to improvise. I mean, can't you just say limitation, only weapons, all the weapons have an AP of whatever, just like you did with the strength of any bug?
Right,
know?
Yeah.
That was like really easy to do. And I don't know, sometimes they're just like, it's like the designers are talking to you. It's very conversational.
Uh-huh.
It's like, well, I guess, yeah, but we're not pals around a table and what should we fudge? You know, this is a game product. I always felt that this was really, really strange.
Well, the villains themselves are real oddballs. So it could be at that point they just decided, you know what, if we get hung up trying to create this game mechanic, we're going to have to use it again some other day. So like, just fudge it, folks. But I don't know. I don't have a problem fudging that. I've done a ton of times where I've done a game where I don't even have stats for the characters. I just like, okay, they're probably like, you know, this sort of number. They could probably do this ability. You know, I just roll some dice kind of thing.
Sure, but that's what we do in real life.
It's true.
When you put out a product, and there was room. There's a giant half-page image of the Faceless Hunter. You know, there's room.
Nobody cares. It's the Faceless Hunter. Anyway, well, let's get going here on the encounters. There's eight of them, right?
Right. So here's the basic synopsis, right? A Manhunter tape with all the Justice League secrets has accidentally fallen into the hands of Manga Khan, who's offering it as a prize on his interplanetary game show. So the first adventure was a talk show. This one's a game show. So to keep their information from reaching any of their enemies, Justice League Europe must compete against the Forgotten Villains. I think we can really divide the module into two parts. Part one is used as a hook for the players, get them into the story, find out about the tape, track it down, discover it's off-world. And then part two takes us to space as the JLE apply to be on Manga Khan's game show and try to win it away from the Forgotten Villains who had the same idea. So in part one, let's take this one first. The heroes are sent on a small mission by Interpol. They'll find clues that could lead them to Juan Donovan or his French connection, and ultimately to the new intergalactic cable network in Geneva, and discover along the way that Donovan made a copy of the Manhunter tape, and that you can hop one of ICN's shuttles to a crazy game show where you can win it as a prize.
Now, at the beginning, though, the strange thing is that when Interpol hires them, it's not to go after a supervillain. It's just like, hey, there's some criminals and something's going to go down. Will you guys go check it out? And it's like, isn't that a job for the cops at this point? So it's a little strange that Interpol hired them for the, or asked them to help with this. It doesn't feel like a very Justice League kind of mission.
No. You're right. I mean, the fix is make Lefebvre a supervillain.
And now
there's a reason for Interpol or local police. I'm not even sure this is an Interpol problem, you know, but the authorities can now ask for the jailee's help. Well, why would you for just like a stakeout and, you know, just like mobsters are meeting and we don't know why?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem important enough.
The other thing, too, which is a little strange, they introduced the chief of operations for Interpol in Paris, this character, Philippe Chevalier, I don't know.
Philippe Chevalier, it was just, you know, like Maurice Chevalier.
Like you know
the
French,
actor.
French or something, whatever.
Philippe Chevalier.
So the strange thing is that there is already an Interpol liaison assigned to the Justice League Europe by, like, issue one, Inspector Camus, or Camus, however you want to say it. He is right there in the book. So if they're on issue 9 or 10 by now, they definitely should know who that character. So it's a little strange they picked a different Interpol guy because it's not related to the plot. They just randomly picked a dude. So I thought that was a little strange as a JLE reader. Thought that was weird.
Yeah, and as a JLE literate game master, you would obviously change this to Inspector Kebu.
Right.
Of course.
And I do like that there's this bit here in the first encounter, and we're not going to spend a whole bunch of time breaking down each encounter, folks, but I do love the part where there's this part where they tell you the player should debate whether to take this Interpol job and decide who's going. In my experience in role-playing sessions, anytime I turn it over to my players to have a conversation, that's at least a 45-minute talk right there. And they're gonna micro-examine this thing to death. And make sure they've got every safety harness in place before they take this job. And I'll be like, guys, can we just go? You know you're going to go. Can we just go?
I think it's a weird question to ask the players because aren't they all going to go?
Oh, you mean which character should go? That's true. You're supposed to have six players, by the way. It's worth saying.
Right. Let's say you have all six, right? Okay, six is a bit much to just go do this little job.
Yeah.
But also one is too much for this little job. and why would the players just stay home and just watch the other players play?
Yeah.
You wouldn't, you know? So I think this is a very strange idea here. And by the way, the villains, you know, are holed up at 53 Rue de Gaulle in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
No, that doesn't exist. That's not an address. There's no Rue de Gaulle. There's no de Gaulle Street. There's a boulevard.
Okay, well, there was no Google Maps in 1990 for Ray Wininger to look up. So cut the guy a break.
Obviously. But an atlas? No, it's an invented address. You don't want to put a real address on there and say, well, the crooks are meeting at that address. And it's like somebody's going, that's my place.
Well, and they specifically say it's a really bad part of town, too. So, I mean, like...
Yeah, exactly.
Don't want to insult anybody.
So there's some bad railroading here. Because they find these articles and then they're not supposed to go directly to Switzerland. It says, don't let them.
Right.
I'm just like an omniscient voice. I'm not a person in the story that can stop them. You know, if they want to go to Switzerland directly to check out the network, they could. They say there's not enough clues to warrant a trip. Okay, maybe I agree. But you've got the Flash. You've got people who can fly super fast. It's no big deal to get there.
They could have had something that says Catherine tells them if they go, it'll cause an international incident. Now there's an excuse that they used to use all the time in JLE for not doing stuff. At least there you'd have a reason that is marginally reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like even in terms of, I don't want to bash this too much, but in terms of the layout, it's a little messy.
Talk about the graphic design?
Yeah. I mean, the way that they've placed, like, you know, like page 17, the information gained is like in the middle of a column instead of at the bottom. Yeah. And then later on, it is repeated word for word. Because you meet if you get the guy later, then he says the same thing then.
Right.
But it's just like, why not just say, you know, look at that page or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I feel it's a little clunky in terms of the layouts. But nevertheless, these are all encounters that I would remove personally.
And I totally love the font on each encounter. It's like I don't know what they used to, it's the equivalent of, I don't know, some sort of crazy font from the old day, from like a, you know, again, from like print shop or something. Like, I totally remember that font from back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like a page maker kind of
something. Yeah.
Kind of font.
So jumping forward, I do like in Encounter 4, they discover some stuff in the trash. And like there's this receipt and it's got listed all these things that the bad guy, Donovan, or maybe not so much the bad guy, but this one of the negative NPCs has all these videotapes he's recorded. And one of them is the exposed adventure, the role-playing adventure that we did. But it's dated August 10th, 1989. And I'm wondering if that's a bit of an Easter egg. Because again, we can't find release dates. We don't have Mike's Amazing World for RPGs. So we don't have dates on when specific RPGs were released. But I was wondering, since they specifically tagged it with August 10th, 1989, maybe that's the publication date of the second edition because Exposed was in that box set.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. And that's a fun little bit because that would represent the show that you were on. And the tape, so there's that show plus the Manhunter tape, obviously, that you were trying to get from on the talk show.
Yep.
And I like that one of the shows was, it's all very, Donovan is supposed to be a show like Geraldo or something.
Well, it's very much so. I mean, the whole point was he broke into a vault and found the tape, just like Geraldo broke into Capone's vault. Yeah.
Capone's vault. So it's kind of supposed to be a lampoon of that. Mm. And so the tapes, like, these are his best shows. Yeah, it's supposed to be the best show that he's using as an example to MangaCon because he wants his show to be syndicated to the galaxy, essentially, to the universe. Mm. And one of the examples doesn't sound very exciting. It's superhero role-playing gamers, a bunch of well-adjusted, fun-loving people.
Well, this is 1990. This is not too long from the scare.
Yeah, the satanic scare.
Yeah, exactly. The satanic scare that role players were all, creepy and doing wicked rituals and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah. And basically, I would have skipped to this. Like, this Encounter 4 is the network building. Mm-hmm. And that's where you find some of the clues there. I would have skipped all of this. I would have
The
heroes. Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have skipped this. I would have skipped to this.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I would have had the heroes watch TV. And there's a big, there's an ad in here. They find a publicity for the game show, which mentions the Manhunter tapes as a prize. I would have just had that go out on the air normal. You're at the JLE at headquarters. You're watching TV on monitor duty. Wally is like goofing off. He's watching TV. There's this new network about to launch that is going to have alien programming on it. He's interested. He's looking at it. There's the ad, the commercial for that game show. That's mm-hmm. where they get the clue. Forget all of this mobster nonsense.
And I don't know if we explained it very well enough, but yeah, the whole idea is MangaCon is starting his own cable news or cable channel. This is the era of Ted Turner's Superstation and everything, right? So mm-hmm. he's starting his own cable channel, and that's what the focus of this is some popular game show he's got on there. But there's all kinds of stuff about the network, which is sort of interesting. That's where this big encounter takes place, is at the network offices.
Right. Well, big encounter. There's no one there, so it's like strange. So
they fight a bunch of robots.
Some security robots that they can fight if you need like a little fight there. But it's basically about finding about the game show. And then there's these teleporters that will bring them to the shuttle and so on.
I didn't think about that, but they make a whole big deal about all the clues you gather in there. And like, it's almost hinting that there aren't a lot of aliens involved. It's almost like, you find a little bit of stuff for aliens, but then not the food or the alien plan is fake or whatever. Like, it's almost hinting that there's something a little screwy, but that none of that ever pays off. And
well,
also,
I think like there's chairs that fit only aliens.
Right.
I think it is supposed to be run by aliens. There's nobody. Okay. The fact that there's nobody there.
That never gets played out either.
No, it's a strange. I know they haven't launched yet, but it's just a little bizarre. They could have done more with that.
They even talk about there's areas that are covered in layer dust. I'm like, okay, what is that? What is that telling us? Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
Hmm. All right.
So then we hit what I call part two. The heroes teleport to a space station. They take a shuttle to Alpha Centauri. They audition for Wheel of Jeopardy. And ultimately, they compete against the Forgotten Heroes for the tape on a game show hosted by MangaCon. And that's basically derived from every famous game show you can think of.
Yeah, I mean, Wheel of Jeopardy. It's right there in the name.
Wheel of Jeopardy. Yeah.
Right, yeah. I do like in Encounter 5, there's like they give you like a flight schedule of all the places that these ships are going to. Like, you go to the Wheel of Jeopardy charter, or you can go to the Tamaran Vega Star Group, or whatever. But one of them says the Mutara Nebula. And I'm like, oh, that's fun. And I said, I guess that, in my mind, I'm thinking they must have taken that from Star Trek to be like a real place, and Star Trek just used it. So I Googled it. No, sure enough, they made it up for Star Trek. So that was very exciting to me.
And JLI had a number of Trek references. Remember?
Yes.
I think in Invasion in particular, you know, they were making Star Trek jokes. Giffen DeMatteis, yeah. So that's not JLE, but as we'll see, this is, you know, leaning much more towards the JLI sense of humor than what was being done in JLE.
Well, anytime DeMatteis was involved with scripting, there were lots of Star Trek references.
Yeah.
So yeah. It would fit, because he scripted the first, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 issues of JLE, so that works.
Okay, well then there you go. And other destinations from the DCU, of course, but also Chicago O'Hare. You can get...
Oh.
arriving from, so there is a shuttle taking from Chicago to this space station around Jupiter somehow. So it's just, again, these are kinds of jokes.
Episode. Well, it'll just be delayed, I promise.
Well, actually, the flight you take is delayed because it says, you know, you can make it like they're running for it and they can't miss the shuttle, but you can make it close and then it takes off an hour after, you know.
Right, yeah.
Encounter 5 also has the Swoonies, which they have literature, including that little guide for Wheel of... Jeopardy.
Right, which is the inside cover that you're supposed to photocopy and hand out to your players.
Right, so the Swoonies are sort of occultists who are, they also have, the literature also includes the Batman role-playing game. So another little inside joke. They're obviously Moonies.
Yeah.
I think it would have been a cleaner joke, you know, if the terminal had been on the moon. Or at least a moon, and then you would call them Moonies, turning them to Swoonies. I don't know. Maybe you don't want to insult the actual religion.
Well, I mean, they were still a thing at this point. So, yeah, I mean, they weren't, you know, an old joke. It was like something going on modern. It worked for me, because first they introduced the fact they're from the planet Swoon. And I'm like, oh, okay, they're from the planet Swoon. And then they got to Swoonies. I'm like, oh, I should have saw that coming. That's a groaner. That's a good one. Yeah. So I like the joke.
Well, they're doing airplane jokes, right, basically.
Oh, yeah.
And then you also meet Barry Portugal here. Another character that is supposed to be like the show's producer, the game show's producer.
Yeah.
And he's also got a comedy motivation. Love of the industry. There you go. But I don't know what... There's another joke here that I can't parse. What is that joke about him working for an infamous millionaire slash yacht racer slash dictaphone demolitionists?
Okay, so I actually spent a lot of time trying to figure this out.
Okay.
And I actually didn't even know you had it in your notes, but I myself was like, what is this about? So I tried Googling it and had no luck. So I actually went to ChatGPT and asked it for help. And it actually helped me.
Okay.
Turns out, it gave me sent me down a wrong lead, first of all. The dictaphone demolitionist thing is confusing. The person who's most famous for destroying a dictaphone is Winston Churchill. I guess it pissed him off, and so he smashed one.
Okay.
But the rest of it, though, the yacht racing, the temper, the cable network, all that stuff, boom, it got right to it. It's supposed to be Ted Turner, which makes perfect sense. They say they hired him away from another cable source owned by an infamous millionaire yacht racer or dictaphone demolitionist. So I don't know what the dictaphone demolitionist piece of it is, but the rest of it makes perfect sense to be Ted Turner.
Okay. Of course, I would have removed Barry Portugal from this story. I don't think Elrond does enough.
Yeah.
We'll find out he's sort of a Barker's Beauties or, Vanna White or something. I think he could also have been running the show from the backseat, you know, in the background. And I would rather have my players interact with Elrond, known character, than like this guy. He doesn't do enough. It's not interesting enough.
Yeah. And by this point, even though he wasn't a member of the JLA, he still had been appeared enough, like every time MangaCon appeared, that it would work. It still would have made sense for him to do that.
There's these aliens that appear. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have 6 players, you should be trying to recruit some of these guys. So maybe you like the elephant guys. Maybe you like the water guys. Maybe you like... Yeah, at least they have if you don't have 6 players and the game show plays at 6.
Mm-hmm.
What I would do is cut a couple of forgotten villains. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And then, Encounter 6, that's the audition. And then it says, they do the audition and then, they have to improvise a meeting with the forgotten villains.
Mm-hmm.
So it says the heroes are familiar with them, so they should just, have an encounter or whatever. Really? Our heroes are familiar with the forgotten villains? Like Animal Man, yes.
Sure. Well, actually, it's not in continuity anymore, so maybe not, but...
Well, yeah. I would say that's still in continuity.
Okay.
Animal Man was in the Forgotten Heroes, and that's still in continuity.
Okay.
So, just like who was in that team and under what circumstances. So, you know, I would have Animal Man know who they are, and Captain Atom knows who Dr. Spectro is.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys are so obscure. There's no way you can actually make this case. So that's a strange assertion.
The other one you could do, and this is me using foreknowledge for stories that come later, but Ralph, being part of the satellite era of Justice League, you know, Batman had all those rules and meetings. So you could argue that Ralph was aware of who they were from, like, a briefing from the old Justice League era. Okay. But that's a stretch. And that's really me thinking forward to the Star Wars adventure where Ralph knew who all that was.
Nice pun.
Oh my gosh, that was an accident, but I love it. So Encounter 7, I just want to mention this one. So Encounter 7 is like, if they decide to steal the tape, which is, again, what Firestorm did in our adventure, if they decide to steal the tape, here's what you need to do. It's an entire encounter. It's just one page. Or is it? How many pages is it? Is it just one page?
No, it is. It is just one page.
Yeah, it's just one page. But it is an entire encounter specifically designed to frustrate the players, right? I mean, that is literally everything they do. And it has a tremendous amount of information on how to frustrate the players. And I just think it's asinine. Like, why wouldn't you just have the GM say, you tried and you failed, or something like that?
I would put, a 50 AP force field around the prizes, which is, you know, impregnable.
Yeah.
So that's it. Oh, security systems, security robots that match your powers. They're just like, under each security system, there's another security system. And the last one disintegrates the hero forever.
I mean, you literally could play this encounter for an hour. I mean, that literally, all the different levels you have to go. It's like Die Hard. You have to get through 14 locks or whatever, right? You have to go through all the different locks. And each lock becomes progressively more impossible to the point where the writer just wants them to fail. So it's like, all you're doing is, you're frustrating the players and you're crushing their creativity. I mean, that's a lesson I learned as a GM a long time ago when I had one of these type of encounters where I knew the heroes were going to lose. That was the way the story was set up. And I made them role play every single bit of it. I made them roll everything. I made them get as creative as they could to win, and they still lost. And at the end, I realized all I did was like crush their spirits. When your heroes are going to lose, you very quickly move through it. You just say, oh, you know what? You tried. It didn't work out. But hey, you know, we're going to go on to the next encounter now, and you might have another chance to do something different instead of sitting there and beating them down over and over and over. It's just
agreed.
Not good.
No. And it's clear that, like, well before this point, that much of the humor in Come On Down is about frustrating the heroes with delays, with impossible tasks, with uncollaborative NPCs. Like, nobody answers your questions no matter what. You know, a lot of stuff like that, that it is supposed to play as part of the comedy, but I think goes way too far. Like, I've used this method, mm-hmm. this technique. Usually I've, like, one PC that I treat like a punching bag. There is one unlucky, unloved character in every bunch. Mm-hmm. And all my NPCs always, like, pile on that person. I love doing that. The more seriously the person takes themselves, the more they're likely to be that punching bag.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. But a little goes a long way. And this goes, like, way too far. It's no longer comedy, like, by this point. Yeah, it's too much. Encounter 8 is the Wheel of Jeopardy. It's like, is it like 4 pages? Like, more than 4 pages to get through each of the events. There's like 10 events that you have to go through.
I get the feeling that when they came up with this module, they came up with the Wheel of Jeopardy first.
Oh, yes.
Like, I think they came up with this first and then built a whole adventure around it. Like, this is clearly where the writers wanted to put all their time and effort into.
I mean, you're supposed, if you're playing it at the table, which is one of the complexities here, if you're playing online now, it should be like the normal. You know, you need, there are props. You need like a salad bowl and rubber bands. And so there's some of these challenges are going to be represented by dexterity tricks that you would play in your gaming room. You know, so I think that's sort of the fun stuff that DC Heroes often went to. Like, we covered Don't Ask, the ambush bug.
That's exactly what it made me think of.
Right. It had elements like this because ambush bug springs out of the module and he's in your living room or your dining room or wherever you play. So it's kind of has that humor to it. Mm-hmm. But of course, you're going to have to do some work to fit it into an online game. I mean, here's part of the humor of just the writing of it. You've got like a coin toss to decide which team goes first. If it lands on its side, give the players 10 times the hero points, and the adventure is over.
Right. Yeah. If the coin lands vertically up and
vertically,
down.
Yeah. Let's just go home. Stuff like that. I mean, it's not necessary, but it makes for a more fun reading, maybe.
Yeah.
You've got some game show parodies here. This is where you play your dice rolls, and the heroes are actually doing things, and you yourself are doing those dexterity tricks at the table. It's not always well thought out. Some of these events, there's a quiz. There's a quiz question about Red Trinity.
Yeah, some of the trivia questions are very 1990 DC Comics, and you really got to be in deep. And some of them are even made up intentionally for them to lose, like who's a famous person in the cosmos? Like there's no way the players would know.
Well, they don't have to because that's a question for the villains.
Oh, is that
so? The villains are scripted to miss it. Okay. But the Red Trinity question is for the heroes, like a who's Soviet trio of super speedsters. But you've got the Flash on the team. So I don't care if the players don't know the answer. The Flash is going to know the answer. That happened to him within the last few months.
Yeah, yeah.
Of his life. So there's elements like that. Obviously, you would change it to whatever, you know, like your universe. What are they likely to get, not so likely to get? But it depends. Like I played DC Heroes with a lot of people who hadn't read the comics, really.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this would be like they would lose these quiz events.
Well, this is why I prefer to play original characters anyway. Normally, I don't enjoy playing established heroes in a game, like because I feel like there is that whole dichotomy of what's their existing personality and what knowledge do they have that I don't. Whereas you play an original character and it's what you got in front of you. But
yeah, I usually kept the DC actual DC characters for guests.
Yeah, exactly.
So some guy, you know, some old gamer, some old player of mine comes to town for a weekend, we're playing, you want to come? Sure. Okay, here's Blue Devil.
There you go.
You know, which is an actual example that I've done. Here's Red Tornado. You know, and here's what you need to know. So
as far as the jumping back to the skill stuff with like the salad bowl where you're throwing pennies or you're shooting rubber bands at the GM screen, I actually thought those were a lot of fun because I'm still gaming in person with my group and I could totally see us doing these ridiculous challenges and really cutting up and laughing at each other's, you know, skill success or skill failures. I think it's a fun idea. I don't know that these are exactly like pennies into a salad bowl. I don't know. Maybe we could do something better. But either way, I found it to be a lot of fun.
I think so too, because I've talked about this on Let's Roll in some other episode. The game within the game. And yeah. I'm a big proponent of that, of like, let's shake things up. And suddenly I take out like a board game or a chess board and then the players have to play a game as if their characters are playing the game.
Yep.
Or it's just like changing their, you know, it's like, well, let's play like a racing game, but your characters are actually in a race, you know, in a vehicle race, but we're going to play it as a racing game, which is like a board game or some Formula D or something. So every time I've done this, the players have always responded well. And it's like, oh, this is kind of fun. And they get to play something they haven't played before. And I don't think they miss the role-playing element because they're still role-playing. They're still speaking in their character's voices while they do this. You know, you have to keep focus on who they're supposed to be playing, even though you're just like layering in a new game. But yeah, this is the reason I wanted to play it. This is the reason I wanted to eventually get to this. But now that we play online, it's like, oh, that's a little more complicated. It's interesting to do this, you know, and it all ends in once you've done, you know, you've done your Jeopardy, you've done your Price is Right, you've done your Let's Make a Deal, etc. Then it all ends in a pie fight.
Well, it's a fight, but pies give you extra bonuses if you throw a cream pie in somebody's face.
Then you really should, right? Yeah. So I can imagine the Flash advantage, right? The Flash is just like throwing these pies like a machine.
Yep.
And he can refuel on the pies as he goes because this is the Wally when he needs to eat a lot to keep it up. So yeah, it ends in a big pie fight. It's amusing. Again, the railroad of this is like, well, whatever happens, the forgotten villains, if they win the tape, then somehow they lose the tape.
Mm.
You know, like somehow they're called, I don't know, cheaters or something. It's like the intergalactic police comes in because they stole that space truck. And so they lose by default. And now you can buy the tape. It's like, let's just have the villains win the tape and cause problems for the heroes.
Right. Exactly.
Just take it to the next level. So I don't know why they insist on doing this. It's like the whole thing is kind of written in such a way as like we have this story in mind and your characters are going to be part of it, but also it's going to start and end the way the story as written works. So it never comes off its railroad. You know, essentially. It's too bad.
So would you use this adventure? You know, so now that you've gone through it, you've gone to the details of it, I could totally see you doing, like as I was reading this, the Wheel of Jeopardy games, you know, the rubber bands. I specifically was like, oh, that's a Siskoid thing to do. Would you think you would run this?
It absolutely is my kind of thing, right? As you know, one of my outstanding contracts is writing questions for a French-Canadian quiz show on TV. And I was asked because I was a well-known organizer of game show type activities when I was working at the local university. So in other words, I'm looking at this game show and I see all the flaws in Wheel of Jeopardy. So I probably fixed a lot of things to make it work.
Okay.
And I did always want to play it, and because I played Exposed 3 times.
Wow.
You know,
okay.
Like I had like 2 different DC Heroes groups, the Free Spirits and the Crusaders, and they both went through it. So I was always planning to get to Come On Down as a sequel. And then we also played it together,
right.
Exposed, I mean, right, on the show here.
Mm-hmm.
And I did speak to the group of players that we had then. And they were game to do it, to like to do another real play episode. And this was like a year ago when we discussed it. So it's entirely my fault that I just couldn't see how to do it on my current schedule.
A live game, role-playing game is so much effort. And
it's a lot of, I mean, it's a lot more prep.
Oh, yeah.
It's also like, okay, you need like, you know, you've got 5 people on the microphones. You need to edit it afterwards. You need
so
to remove.
So much more editing than a normal podcast.
Yes. So I just, this isn't a good time. So we decided to just do it this way. So my apologies to the prospective players, but this JLE would have been like that JLI. You would have picked your own characters, fetish characters. You know, Shaggy would have been Blue Devil this time around.
Oh, I am specifically owed an apology because I finally was going to get to play Blue Devil, but that's okay. I accept your apology.
And then Bass was going to play Wally West.
Yes.
Straight out of this module. So that's great. That, you know, that's one of his favorite heroes. David Gallagher was going to be some weird DC hero from non-canon alternate media source. To be determined. I don't know.
Of course he would.
Of course. Like El Dorado or something. And so we never got that far with Chris Franklin. But potentially, I think you would have had fun with Elongated Man here.
Okay.
And then we would have written up or found Sue Dibney's stats. And then, you know, Cindy could have jumped on the microphone.
Absolutely.
Punched his arm or something. but yeah, so as a module, there's a lot I would change, you know, like I said, I would like get rid of the front part. Anyway, if we would have played online, I would have wanted it to be shorter.
Yeah.
So I would have taken out all the detective work, just send you to the network directly, tighten it up, maybe fewer events on the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because 10 events is a long time. And then so you can remove the stuff that doesn't quite work. You know?
And one of those events had like 8 little sessions within it, too. Yeah.
Mini events within it. Some are like very short, like, you know, the Price is Right one is like, here are these items. How much do you think all of these together are worth in megabucks or something? That's done. Boom. You know, it's so easy. But other ones, you know, took longer. So I'm not sure we would have gone through the 10 plus a pie fight. So, okay. So I'm the host of Let's Roll normally. So that was a fair question to ask. Let me ask the question to the JLI host.
Mm-hmm.
How does this rate as a JLI story or a JLE story?
Well, and that's the interesting distinction, right? Because if we're just talking Justice League Europe, right, which is what this is supposed to be, there are some nice things in here. Like you do, again, you have a section in Paris, you have a section in Italy, you have a section in Switzerland, which is great because those early issues of JLE really use the European setting to their advantage. Like they'd have encounters where 2 characters went here, and 2 characters went there, and 2 characters went here. So that feels very JLE, early JLE, which is great. The wacky hijinks with Manga Con, that does feel more Justice League America than Justice League Europe, because there was, especially in the early days, there was a distinction where Justice League Europe was supposed to be the more action-oriented series. It was targeted at the classic JLA readers, trying to get them to come back, saying, hey, look, we're going to have our funny Justice League America, but we're going to have a more serious Justice League Europe. That didn't last that long. But that was the original intention, was to have a more serious Justice League Europe. So I feel like the humor, the hijinks, a little more JLA. But, for example, the Intergalactic Cable New Network, whatever it's called, IGCN, which I love that idea, by the way. But that feels very JLA, not necessarily JLE.
Because all the cluster stuff, that was all in JLA, right? It was never in JLE. You know, it's like
MegaCon showed up like 1 or 2 panels here or there. Like they traded Starro to MegaCon, I want to say, at one point or something like that. So MegaCon was in a tiny end page or something like that.
Yeah, this is more like an anomaly, like the French Lesson issue.
So good.
You know? Yes, but also more like a JLA
yeah.
You know, type story. So it's not impossible, especially in those early days.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to say, okay, but yeah, definitely this would have been a JLI or JLA story. And I think they were just like maybe trying to get more variety out of it. You know, we just did one with the JLA. Let's do one with the JLE.
Yeah. And at this point, too, the JLE wasn't cemented yet. It was still the early days, so they didn't know which way we go. No, ultimately, it's fine. If you're enjoying the JLE, it's fine. You know, it's not exactly what I would expect, but it's very passable. And again, I my brain always goes to how I would run this and adapt it for original characters. Like, I actually thought, like, could I adapt this for my group right now? And I got ideas percolating. I don't know. Maybe I can. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's what I would have done in my home games, obviously. It wasn't, you know, it was your own heroes trademark. But what would be fun, and maybe you want to do this if you ever want to go down this road, it would be fun to introduce the forgotten villains over several sessions. Like start stories with a teaser each game, and one of your heroes in your game easily defeats one of these losers. And then this becomes the big rematch.
Right?
So that, it could be an interesting one, because otherwise they're very obscure. And unless your players are comic book nerds, they're just not going to get the joke.
Well, off the air, I'll tell you something I'm working on for my game right now, but I don't want to say on the air because maybe my players are listening, but
right.
It's not the furthest away from an idea I've had before.
But even I, rereading this, even I had notions of, is there something I could do with this in my Torg Eternity game? Which is not a superhero game, but again, I can't say too much in case one of them listens, but there is an element in the campaign right now which could stand in for the Manhunter tapes.
All right, well, before we give away our secrets, you know, just like the Justice League here, why don't we take a podcast promo break, and then when we come back, we will hit y'all's feedback from the last time we did one of these crossovers between JLI and Hero Points. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Siskoid watches a lot of movies, like a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast, or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Power Seven Man. Soldiers of
Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire and Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
We are back, and we're looking at feedback from our previous episode, which was, what was it?
When a Stranger Calls.
When a Stranger Calls, exactly. A JLI module very early with the Phantom Stranger, was the Stranger in it, etc. So, David Gallagher, let's start with him. He's our former player of ours within the concepts of this show, author of Only Living Boy, and an awesome GM on some episodes of Tomb of Ideas, that podcast. He simply says, I'm here for this.
You got the hell of an introduction for that line. But yes, David's always up for some great talk about role-playing, and so thrilled. Thank you so much, David, for listening. Then we're from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. Rob says, only superhero stories can make magic as powerful as it is in superhero stories. It's a little circular logic, but it works, folks. I see where he's going. He says, think about vampires. They're really powerful at night, right until about 6 a.m., or if they fall in water or eat garlic, right? You know, leprechauns are really powerful until you catch them. He goes, but in superhero comics in the 1940s, if you were a magical character, nobody cared enough to make rules for you. You were invincible. Billy Batson needed to say magic words, but the fighting Yank's grandfather's ghost could do whatever. So you make a good point. Yeah, superhero and magic is always a tough combination, which is one of the things we were up against with that module. Yeah.
Bucky749, who has his own YouTube channel, he's behind. He's talking about that real play episode that we had. He says, I listened to the live playthrough you guys did, and it was great. Chris really channeled Adam West, and whoever was playing Firestorm, both guys certainly showed some talent.
Well, that was me and you, Siskoid, so thanks, Bucky. Then we heard from Doug Adamson. He says, oh, wow, a floor plan of the JLI Embassy? I would love to see that. I'm trying to build my own version out of Lego. And the Siskoid, of course, directed him to our image gallery, where he was able to get that. And then he says, as to the podcast itself, I've never actually RPG'd. My wife used to play D&D, and my kids and I are trying to convince her to GM us and try it out. But now I wonder if an on-the-rails setup like this might be better for us. Well, Doug, it's been a year and some change, so hopefully you've had a chance to roleplay by now.
Diablo Frank from the Rollspine Podcast Network, the Martian Manhunter blog, Idle Head of Diablo, and the Terminator Now podcast, which just recently started. He says, I actually did run a single Mayfair campaign with a group of friends in the late 90s and early 2000s that lasted a number of months. Attempts at a second campaign incorporating more Marvel elements and individual play fell apart after a few sessions. I was a terrible GM, and my players just maxed out their fighting stats and punched things very hard. It was basically role-playing as a side-scrolling fighting game, but we had fun with it. That's all that counts. Also, my girlfriend has been playing Dungeons & Dragons throughout the pandemic with numerous groups, so I have a fair amount of peripheral exposure at this point. Yeah, and I was actually in the game there, suggesting suggesting play styles, etc. So we had conversations beyond this simple comment.
I love this because, you know, like, I spent a number of years not role-playing, and then I got back into it again around 2019, and I'm so glad I did. I mean, there's just so much fun to be had when you're sitting there with your friends goofing around and just and guiding them. Again, we had a guy came and sat in with us, and he described the role-playing session as a writer's room because everybody's contributing ideas. And as somebody says something, boom, that's part of the game now. Someone says, you know, oh, well, what if this were to happen? Boom. I say, okay, that happened. You know, it's like everyone contributes. Everyone builds the world around us. And it's just a fun way to spend time with friends.
Agreed.
Then we're from Brian Litton. It says, I agree that using riddles in game sessions can be really hit or miss. What I've seen used more effectively are puzzles, particularly ones that can be physically manipulated by the players. The Clue Keeper and Batman's Mind Maze are steps in that direction. A GM who I've seen use some cool puzzles in her D&D games is Deborah Ann Wall of Netflix Daredevil fame. Oh, that's awesome. I knew she was really into D&D, and I knew she had a channel, but I haven't watched any of it, but that's awesome that she's doing that. One of my players ran us through an adventure for a couple months, and he was great at using tabletop devices. Like he had a chessboard out, and we had to move the pieces for certain things. We had math puzzles we had to solve. We had, you know, all these kind of fun puzzles that were really great, and it made me feel like an inferior GM. So I'm like, oh, well, I don't ever do that kind of cool stuff. So, but yeah. Yeah, very inspirational, lots of fun.
And Robert Maloney here says, I like to think that if When a Stranger Calls is canon, then Nice Guy, Guy Gardner, is the one refereeing the basketball game at the beginning there. He was a PE teacher after all.
That's good. Great. I like that.
I love for you guys to check out the much superior World in the Balance module, especially since it draws from a lot of juicy Justice League continuity and involves both teams. But because it barely falls outside the Bwahaha era, I'll just say you guys will love it. Every DC Heroes product is eligible for an episode of Hero Points at some point, right? But as far as the Bwahaha tie-ins go, this is not one of them. You know, Come On Down was the last.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at World in the Balance RPG. I don't remember this one.
It's one of the last ones.
I know I've got it on
published.
I know I've got it on a shelf over there.
Yeah, it's super thick.
Oh,
It's like a double, like it's got like action for the JLA and then action for the JLE or the JLI possibly at that point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, this is definitely post Giffen DeMatteis. Yep. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that's a great suggestion, Robert. Thank you. I'll have to check that out. Maybe I'll steal some ideas.
There you go. If you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts and leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. This helps us host all the content that you crave and some of the content you don't. whether this show or these two shows or the ones that are crafted by our amazing partners.
So our thanks go out to these Patreon supporters who asked to be recognized on either the JLI podcast or Let's Roll. So a very special thank you to Bill Beer, Christopher K. Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Michael Zomkowski, Roger Preve, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Raider Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, and Tim Price. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts.
Join the conversation. Our website is at fireandwaterpodcast.com/HeroPoints, I guess, or /JLI. But, just go to the main website and find the appropriate show where you can leave comments. Please. We'll read them in a year or so.
Right, exactly. Whenever we get around to a JSA thing. You can also find us on Facebook as the Fire and Water Podcast Network or JLI Podcast. And on Twitter, you can find us as FW Podcast or as JLI Podcast. And we're on Blue Sky as FW Podcast. Now, folks, come back next month through the JLI podcast when we discuss the action figures produced by DC Direct in a line of toys specifically for Justice League International. It's going to be fun.
And watch the feeds for more role-playing content on this feed in the coming year. Until then, I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Shag. And you've been listening to the JLI podcast
and the Hero Points podcast. Let's roll. Want to make something of it?